Hi, this is Paul, and I have a very special guest today, Dr. Nathan Jacobs. I first became aware of him watching a video from the Orthodox Church in America, I believe. Luke, who I'm going to talk to later today, sent me a link to these videos, and I was absolutely intrigued by them. And then I watched the movie that he made, Becoming Fully Human, and I learned that he had spent time at Calvin Seminary and Calvin College, where, you know, I am from. And so I knew I simply had to talk to Nathan. And so that's what we're going to do today. So Nathan and I, we had a brief phone call before where we got to know each other a little bit, but we really haven't spoken much. Mm-hmm. And so Nathan, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to watch some very long lectures and then proceed to actually look at them with some amount of depth on your own channel. I'm always impressed whenever somebody says, oh, I watched your lectures. And I thought, really? I was exhausted just giving those. I can imagine listening to an hour and a half, but anyway.
I thought they were wonderful. I thought they were terrific. They were very much right up my alley. Part of the beauty of having a YouTube channel is that I have these people out there who, when they see something that they think I'll like, they send it to me, and often they're right. One of the things that I did laugh at quite a bit during those lectures, I don't know who did the recording, but there are a lot of shots of the back of the heads of the listeners. And if you get a bunch of priests and people my age, you get a bunch of bald spots and gray hair. And the cinematography was quite dramatic for those videos. I love that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, fair enough. I was not involved in the cinematography. That was ancient faith there. And so if you like it or didn't like it, you know, I'll leave that between you and ancient faith. I was there to speak. That was my job.
Well, I was so completely intrigued, not only by your presentation, but also by your film and by your story. So I thought maybe a good place to start the conversation today, for those who haven't had the benefit of watching your movie yet, I think probably after this, some folks will find it on Amazon Prime, which, mm-hmm. So you can, if you have Amazon Prime, you can just watch it. You don't have to buy it. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we, you went into quite a bit of depth about your story, and the premise of the film was talking to nuns and duns, of which you considered yourself one of them. Could you give us a little version of your story and you know how you came to faith and faith in the practice in the Orthodox Church? I mean, it's a very interesting story to me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's interesting. We'll see if anybody else finds it interesting.
But, trust me.
So I was raised in my mom was Missouri Synod Lutheran. And so I come from a long line of German Lutherans on her side, taught growing up that, you know, the Roman Catholic Church was the Antichrist and things like that. It was very conservative Lutheran. And whereas on my dad's side, he was not really somebody who practiced anything, at least when I was growing up. I think he's started to have his own faith journey in recent years. But as a child, I really had no idea if what he believed, you know, about God or religion or any. As I said in the film, I knew what he thought about unions. I knew what he thought about politicians. But about God and the meaning of life, I wasn't so sure. And as I got to know him, as I got older, I realized that his mother was very deeply religious, but in this sort of Missouri, backwoods sort of Missouri Pentecostal sort of way. And then his dad was a complete pagan. So, you know, he came from a mixed family as well. And I think how that played out is he had some vague sense of spirituality, but it wasn't really a fully formed sense of spirituality. And then he sort of deferred to my mom in terms of all matters of religion for raising the kids. And she sent me to a private Lutheran school growing up. So I was catechized in the Lutheran church and, you know, communed and confirmed in the Lutheran church. And I just kind of took that all as a default. But for me, I don't know how much exposure you have to Lutherans, but growing up, my impression was the only thing that mattered in terms of religion, what Christianity boiled down to, as far as I knew, was that if you think that you can earn God's favor, that's detrimental to your soul. What's important to understand is that Jesus died for your sins, and then there's a pretty specific understanding of what that means. And as long as you believe that, all is well. And really, that's the sum total of being a Christian, which left me with a big question mark of, well, what do you do? Like, I mean, I guess, okay, check. I believe that. Now I guess I'll go just live my life like a heathen. And which is exactly what I actually did. And that's why I think a lot of the spirituality started to fall away, because it had no real substantive practice behind it. It just had a basic believe this one premise or conclusion, I suppose, and everything else, and that's kind of it. You're all set. And yet with that, one of the things that I think was perhaps a little more unique to me, maybe not, but my impression talking to other nuns and duns is this was a little more unique to me. My mom was deeply concerned about apologetics. So she would introduce me to certain Christian apologists when I would press on a question, and which was pretty normal in our family. I mean, we would debate, right? You sit around the coffee table, dinner table, pounding the table, arguing about things. That was just normal family conversation. I actually remember my wife, whose family quite literally talks about the weather. I didn't know. I thought that was a saying. I didn't know there were people who actually talked about the weather until I first met her family. And they said, you know, a big storm came through last weekend. I thought, they're really talking about the weather. That's a thing. That's amazing. And anyway, whereas my family, you'd sit there and you'd argue and you'd debate. And I remember my wife had to get used to this because she would come away, you know, and tears and mortified from our family gatherings because she said, you guys hate each other. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, I heard you in there arguing and you're shouting. And we're like, that's just normal, good conversation. So apparently that wasn't, you know, quite normal, I guess. So at least it was normal for ours. Maybe that's a Chicago construction worker family sort of thing. I don't know. But anyway, so that was the environment I came from. And so, you know, I was used to things like I asked pretty early on certain questions about first time I read the book of Genesis. My impression of Genesis was, you know, it sounds kind of like Moses is describing the world. I'm probably in like junior high when I'm asking this. Sounds like he's describing the world like there's a dome and there's water above the dome and then there's like earth and then there's these foundations and there's water below the foundations and like that's what opens up in the flood narrative. And my mom said, well, that's not true. Here's Hugh Ross. And she gave me Hugh Ross, who I don't know if you're familiar with his apologetic stuff, but he's a long earth creationist, quantum physicist type guy who became turned Christian apologist. Anyway, it doesn't matter what you think about Hugh Ross, but the thing that was interesting about it was I was immediately encountering this idea that, oh, you can ask hard questions and you might find answers. And if you press those hard questions, you start to, you know, dig down deep into foundations and maybe find new and interesting insights. And that happened to me quite a bit. And I think with that, also, my mom instilled in me this lack of fear about asking questions. So she would also, or even defying certain historically orthodox parameters. By that I mean lowercase o, not Eastern Orthodox, obviously, because she would send me to school and say things like, oh, by the way, in school they might tell you that the earth was created in like, you know, 6 days. That's not true, just ignore that. And so I was like, oh, okay, you know, I guess you just ignore that. So anyway, what that ended up doing is once I hit a point in my high school years where you know, I was, on the one hand, I had become familiar enough with apologetics and enjoyed arguing with people enough that I would be sitting there at a party where we're all stoned, to be, you know, candid, right? You know, we're all on different hallucinogens. Somebody brings up like hell and I jump into the theological discussion just for fun because good academic intellectual sparring is, you know, that's a good time, you know, as far as I was concerned growing up. And we'd have debates, but I didn't really have any sort of practice that went with it. You know, there was an intellectual exercise to it, but there was no substantive spirituality that went with it. But then what happened is at some point I fell into a bit of a crisis, a personal crisis, as I came to see my own mortality and impending death. And I'll chance actually putting out there, I was vague about this in the film, but I'll take the risk of actually being completely transparent about what sparked it. I was on an acid trip, and I was having a really bad acid trip. And what made it particularly bad was I was having certain realizations about consciousness and the soul, and specifically what I would recognize now as I was sort of just coming to realize Socrates' argument from affinity for the immortality of the soul. So Socrates' argument from affinity is basically the idea that you have two types of features of reality, things that are organic and can break down and decay and, you know, fall away, dissipate. And then you have things that are these invisible immaterial realities like numbers, laws of logic, laws of physics. And those things don't decay and break down and erode and aren't subject to that sort of change. And Socrates' argument is that consciousness itself is much more like the latter than it is like the former. So what that means is even though the body breaks down and decays, that doesn't mean consciousness itself will break down and decay and dissipate. Well, while I was on LSD, what I started to realize was I really want to get off of this bad acid trip, but how do I get off of it when I am, my own consciousness is the ride? How do you get off the ride when you are the ride? Mm. And that was a deeply disturbing question for me, especially because I did think of things like, well, if I kill my body, will that actually kill my consciousness? And I thought, maybe not. Maybe my consciousness is actually more than just my body. And essentially I started going through this sort of Socratic argument for the immortality of the soul. And even though, you know, I came, thankfully, I didn't do anything like, well, I'll give it a whirl and, you know, kill myself. Instead, what I did is I realized, you know, okay, I'm going to just sort of ride out the acid trip and it'll calm down. I actually picked up the Bible and tried to read it because I was so freaked out by the question. And I started reading Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. I don't think I got past two sentences over 4 hours because reading on LSD is really, really hard. But what happened was that awakened in me this realization that I'm mortal and my body is going to die. And if my consciousness survives death and I have some sort of capacity to shape that into something desirable or undesirable, there may be ramifications for that. It's possible that I'm shaping myself into something that is damnable, right? And that I'm, you know, sort of positioning myself for something like hell. Now, I think one of the things that I tried to convey this part in the film, and I hope it came through, but I wasn't really so much concerned about like being locked in a torture chamber with demons who are going to jab you or something like that. I was more obsessed with the fact that, kind of like the, you know, the acid trip, the state of my own consciousness, the state of my own soul, can be a place of torment, right? Where the places are more allegorical and the real problem is the condition of the soul. And that's, of course, something I later discovered was a common thread in the Eastern Church Fathers, you know, people like Chrysostom saying, I have no need of a place called heaven when I could become heaven, right? Paradise being the condition of the soul. And Basil saying the same thing about Adam, right? He was in paradise because he was in communion with God, and then he was immediately out of Eden when he sinned because he broke communion with God. And that's when he found himself in a different place. Anyway, that was what sort of hurled me into this journey of really investigating a lot of questions about specifically, do I have free will? Is there a God? What is God like? Maybe God is a tyrant who predestines people for heaven and hell. And maybe I'm on the wrong side of that list. And anyway, so I started really diving into a lot of religious and theological questions, as well as questions about just religion generally. Was I sure that Christianity was the correct religion and all that sort of stuff? So anyway, my delving into those questions started a long path of sort of academic study. And that stretched from you know, that bad acid trip happened in high school, in, like my junior year, and that propelled all the way into, you know, years of crisis about that, into college, into art school, where I was when I was really wrestling with those things pretty deeply and starting to read philosophers and theologians. If I heard there was somebody speaking on a topic that was religious or philosophical, I'd go to the meeting and I'd sit there and I'd listen, and then I'd grill them with questions afterwards because I wanted to find anybody who might have answers. And oftentimes, honestly, I took the questions so seriously that a lot of people who I talked to wondered, you know, is he neurotic? Is he crazy? Because he's taking this question far too seriously. Whereas I thought, you clearly don't understand the gravity of what I'm asking if you don't take it seriously. Because I started to see, wow, like free will is a really serious thing. If I really have that and I have the capacity to shape myself or misshape myself in some sort of, you know, way that could ultimately become permanent, that's a huge weight. If I survive death and my choices here affect what happens afterwards, that's a huge weight. If we're bound by a deity, right, who is a tyrant, we might not be able to do anything about it, but that's a real problem. And so all of those things really pressed in on me and drove me. I would say crisis, you know, is the right word for where I was at in terms of trying to wrestle through those questions. Anyway, I talk about it obviously in the film, but I think the short version is, even though this has already been a long version, the short version is that I ended up becoming so preoccupied with those questions that I was really neglecting art. And so in my junior year of art school, I actually left art school and I transitioned to study philosophy. And I knew that, you know, philosophy was where I was starting. And so I started reading people like Augustine and Aquinas. And I started reading the folks who I started to discover through just study of their thought, the people who they had read. So I started reading Neoplatonists, Aristotelians, and so on. And then eventually started delving into modern philosophy. Immanuel Kant, I had heard, was very formative on how people think today, but it wasn't just that it was formative. Supposedly he's created some problem for doing metaphysical thinking, which apparently was what I was doing. And so I engaged him. I didn't agree with him at all, even though I've written a lot on Kant's, but you know, he was somebody to be dealt with. I went backwards to Leibniz, who he read. Anyway, I was reading, really, I didn't have a research program necessarily in the formal sense of, well, I'm interested in Kant, so I'm reading Kant and then I'm going backwards. I was just following my questions wherever they led. And so start with the usual suspects in terms of ancient philosophy and ancient Christianity and work your way up through the medievals and into the modern questions and so on, and follow wherever it would go. I would say that kind of how I was thinking about things eventually, once things started to coalesce in my mind, and this pre-orthodoxy, was, you know, the scientific method, you have theories, right? And theory, of course, isn't just a guess, right? Theory is that we have different data points, and the working theory is a way of making those data points cohere, right? And I was doing something similar in the sense that I was looking at all the different data points I could see, right? So I was convinced that the soul, you know, does survive death. So that's a data point. I was convinced that there is a human condition, and that the fact that world religions in general all try to look for ways of addressing that human condition is a relevant data point. For me, it was a relevant data point that Jesus of Nazareth seems to offer some type of exclusivity that wasn't common in other world religions. That became its own data point, as well as certain things I've mentioned in the film. The fact that I entertained the idea that, you know, well, what if Jesus is just a deceiver or a sorcerer or something like that? I explored those sorts of things, and my conclusion was it didn't seem that he was, you know, just a normal guy, because even his opponents never suggested that he was, you know, just a normal guy. Even his opponents believed he was a wonder worker. He had to be a sorcerer or a demoniac or something like that. There was a recognition of something special about the person of Christ, something supernatural about the person of Christ. But then that's where, for me, another data point was, well, then in that case, if we have the options of he's a wonder worker who's, you know, demoniac, or he's the Son of God, as he claims, you have to look at the fruit of what it bears. And looking at the lives of the saints, I said that does not seem to be the fruit of demons. That seems to be the fruit of something good. And so that's where I moved, you know, returned to my Christian roots. But at the same time, my moral intuitions, I came to the conclusion I had to be free in order for moral culpability to make sense. And so I was an advocate of free will. I took the problem of evil very seriously, but the problem of evil was not a point of seriousness in the sense of atheism, because I saw atheism as undercutting the argument. My understanding of the problem of evil required some sort of transcendent morality, that there really is good and evil, whereas if we're just blind, you know, random material, there is no such thing as good and evil. There's pleasant and unpleasant. But there's not good and evil in that sense. And so the argument itself created sort of two data points. On the one hand, created a data point about the goodness of God and the existence of evil that needed to be reconciled, the problem there. And then the second data point, though, was however it's reconciled, you can't get rid of the foundations of transcendent morality, which is why I remained a theist. And so anyway, all of those things eventually started pushing me down, coalescing around a certain way of interpreting a world. And where I ended up landing was actually process philosophy. So process philosophy espoused by Alfred North Whitehead, my favorite theologian. I think he's a philosopher, not a theologian, but Charles Hartshorne was like one of my favorite folks. His book, which would tell you something about how untraditional, non-traditional my theology was Omnipotence and Other Theological Mistakes. So, which I really just liked for the title, but I mean, I also thought it was brilliant because I thought Charles Hartshorne was brilliant. But all of that was partially because even though I had looked backwards at people like Aquinas and Augustine with optimism, there ended up being a major disconnect there. I thought there were major problems in terms of free will, in terms of God-world interactions, and so on. That ultimately pushed me away from that and away from historical Christianity toward this sort of innovative process, you know, sort of philosophical Christianity. So I had really this sort of syncretistic, odd, philosophical, self-constructed worldview, a religion sort of my own making, that really still didn't have any practice. So this was not something to be practiced in church. I wasn't a sacramentalist. Why would I go to church? And I believed in Jesus, which was instilled in me as, you know, a pretty good starting point for being self-identified as Christian, because I didn't have a concept of a visible church or an affiliation with a visible church as necessary to being a self-identified Christian. So as I returned to my Christian roots, I returned to it in, again, this very sort of, I guess I moved from being a nun to a dun, I guess you could say, right? Or really kind of a never was, but, you know, we'll call it from a nun to a dun. But then what happened was this, I mean, so this search that I described, really, it sort of went from degree to degree to degree, because that was the context in which I was doing the searching. So it went from, you know, studying philosophy to getting a degree in church history and systematics, and then on into PhD studies. And it was during my PhD studies that I took a class from a patrologist, right, a patristic scholar, expert on, you know, church fathers, and it was focused on from Nicaea to Constantinople. And that little stretch there, right, the Council of Nicaea to Constantinople, we were reading all primary sources, patristic sources, and they were all Eastern sources because of the prominence of the Eastern fathers in those discussions. I don't know how well-versed your viewers are in East-West, but what I mean by Eastern fathers is, of course, the Roman Empire divided East and West, and the West is the Latin-speaking half of the Roman Empire, and the East is the Greek and Syriac and other things. But they were all in that Eastern part. And so even though I was pretty well versed by this point in Latin theology, Right. I'd spent a lot of time with medievals and the sort of and the antecedent work of Augustine to those medievals, and then even post-Reformation scholasticism, which I was studying under Richard Muller at the time, who's a probably one of the foremost experts in the world on 16th, 17th century scholasticism. Even though I was pretty well versed in all of that, when I read the Eastern Fathers, I was very disoriented by it because I recognized the stark contrast between how they understood Christianity generally and Western Christianity. And it was actually, initially it was just a general curiosity of, I don't know what I'm reading here. You know, this is strange. I thought I knew all the Christian systems, and this is just odd. So that really started an investigation into the Eastern Church Fathers just to try to understand them and what they were saying. And then the more I understood them, the more I found it somewhat compelling what they were saying. In some ways, it seemed to be offering all of the different things. In many ways, if I return to this sort of data point way of thinking about, you know, a working hypothesis, it seemed that their thought represented an alternative hypothesis that accounted for all the data points I was accounting for, but offered more than what I had offered. In addition to offering a connection with historical Christianity and a practice of religion and things like that. So anyway, that's what compelled me to actually at some point reach out to an Orthodox priest, visit an Orthodox church, start conversations directly with the Orthodox. And eventually that sort of was the end result of all that was that I ended up actually becoming Eastern Orthodox. So I trust that suffices as a...
That's terrific. That was absolutely terrific.
Well, thanks.
You'll see, I'll send you the notes. So that was an excellent, I think, wonderful overview of a certain aspect of your life. Now, mm-hmm. You've also got these other interesting elements that I think probably a lot of people watching this conversation will be interested in, mm-hmm. So you're in high school, you have this bad acid trip. And by the way, you know, and depending on where this conversation goes and how many other conversations we want to have, the psychedelic question is a very big deal. I got into this whole YouTube thing via trying to figure out what was going on around Jordan Peterson. Very mm-hmm. quickly, I had people contacting me talking about their experiences with psychedelic drugs. Mm-hmm. I grew up Christian Reformed. Mm-hmm. And I've never smoked pot, much less inhaled. I don't drink alcohol. I've never done any psychedelics. So I have all these people coming to me and it's like, so I've had to get a little bit of an education on this stuff. So the aspect of psychedelics will be something that a lot of the people who listen to my channel will be interested in. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting. After high school, you went to art school. Mm-hmm. That was your first stop. And then at that point, you're realizing you're neglecting your art and you're fixated on philosophy. Mm-hmm. And that sets up a whole, I mean, what does your life look like in all of that? And has art ever come back around? Now, currently you're a lecturer in philosophy in Kentucky.
Yeah. University of Kentucky. Yeah. What does my life look like during that time? And then how does that play? How does it converge now?
Because you wound up, Missouri Synod, that sort of, as Lutherans go, that's kind of Christian Reformed. There's some similarities there. My wife actually grew up part Lutheran and part Fundamentalist Baptist. But that's mm-hmm. a whole another crazy story that mm-hmm. I don't usually tell my wife's story on my channel because it's her story to tell, not mine. So I have some understanding of Lutherans. Uh-huh. So flesh out some of that story too, because that's also interesting.
Yeah. So during art school, you know, initially, ironically, it was all the spiritual stuff that pushed me away from hallucinogens. So I had, you know, I used to be an avid consumer of them. They were a big part of my life, and they were a big part of my art too. You know, I would, it was a normal thing for me to use them to either see a work of art that I had done afresh or in a new perspective, or to break down inhibitions that I realized were present and working in the way I thought about two-dimensionality, and, you know, open up new doors. But once I got to art school and I was really obsessing about philosophy, that started falling away. And in some ways, I would say that what happened was, it was over time I started neglecting in my art because on the one hand, I mean, art school is very intense. I'm guessing that some people probably think, oh, art school, that's like not real school or something relative to more intense
academic. I have a lot of artists that listen to my channel, and I have no idea why, but they'll eat this up, so keep going.
Well, my experience was that art school was a lot harder than, you know, your usual university. So, you know, because at art school, it's extremely, extremely intense full immersion where, you know, if you take a 3-credit-hour class, this was at the Maryland Institute College of Art, where I went, you would be in class for 6 hours that week, and you'd be in class for those 6 hours all at once, right? So it would be an intensive 6-hour period. And then they'd send you home with homework. And, you know, if you're taking 5 classes, you know, and a 15-credit-hour load, that means you're spending 30 hours just in class. And then you have homework for all of those classes. I mean, there were often times where I would go, I think the longest I went with nonstop working and no sleep was 72 hours
wow.
at art school, which had its negative effects as well in its own right. But, you know, it was extremely, extremely difficult and rigorous. And so the problem is trying to juggle that level of rigor while trying to have this, you know, I wouldn't call it a side hustle, but it's functionally kind of like that, right? Where you've thrown yourself into something that really isn't supposed to be what you're doing right now because you're supposed to give all your attention over here. Was extremely difficult. And I think what I started to see is I started seeing my performance in terms of art, not in terms of the skill sets, but in terms of being able to actually produce the quantity I had to produce for art school. It started, you know, to diminish. And even I started sneaking, like I'd go to an art history class and have like some philosophical volume stuffed under my shirt that I sit there and I read while I'm supposed to be listening to an art lecture. At some point it became pretty clear where my interests really were. So that's why the first chance I had for an exit route, was able to open a conversation with my parents who I think were a little shocked by, you want to go study philosophy? That's weird. That's where I took that. But now that said, I mean, it was an interesting thing to be at art school because artists and creatives, you know, they're very open to having these sorts of conversations about the world and creativity. So I had a lot of fantastic conversations, and the conversations obviously changed, the dynamics of them changed very much once I got into a formal academic environment. Now, I think the difference is I expected going from art school into a normal university that I would have a similar type of immersion, right? Oh, I'm going to study philosophy. So it's going to be like the School of Athens or something, right? We're going to have a bunch of philosophers who are as invested in this as I am. And there's some Socratic figure there who's, you know, we're working this all out together and we're dedicating innumerable hours to it. And I found, you know, deeply disappointing that we just go to classes and so many of my peers don't really care about these questions at the, you know, the level I do. But thankfully what I found is there were a couple of professors in particular who I think recognized that I had a vested interest in this topic that was different than than my peers. And also I think they recognize, thank God for, they recognize the good mind under my very unpolished exterior.
Where did you go to school then? Where were you going to school?
So I transferred to Trinity in Deerfield to study there.
Yep.
And partially that was because in all my different reading, I encountered, here and there, a couple of the folks I had read, I had noticed, intersection. There's an intersection between process philosophy and the open theist movement that was happening in the evangelical world. And so I'd read Clark Pinnock at some point in there, and I realized, oh, Clark Pinnock teaches at Trinity. And then I encountered certain other people, you know, certain systematicians or apologists, and I started seeing Trinity. I started seeing graduates of Trinity, and I thought, oh, and then I realized that's only 30 minutes from where I grew up. And so that was actually one of the things where coming home, I came home and initially just spent a semester working for my dad's construction company, and then transferred over to Trinity with the expectation that this being a university, I can study philosophy and then in a fluid fashion move into church history and systematics and basically all of these things that I'm studying I can look at. Now, I think, you know, the other thing that was probably helpful for me was to realize, I now know, looking back, I didn't realize that the level of sort of my disregard for the boundary lines of historical Orthodox Christianity would not have gone over well at the Divinity School had I started there. And I wouldn't have found the sort of freedom that that I did going to the college. So at the college, though, if anybody looks at my publications, you'll notice that I've done a lot of co-authored publications with Chris Firestone. So Dr. Firestone, Chris, was originally my professor, right? And so he was a Kant scholar, and he was a bit of an outlier or an oddity at the college, a relatively recent hire, a young guy, open to all sorts of, you know, still academically enthusiastic and all that. But I think similar to me, I was very, you know, unpolished academically. I was a terrible student growing up. As I said, I was high for most of high school on different things. And really, I sort of, in many ways, I'd say I functioned through high school similar to if you had an elite athlete who doesn't care about academics because they're confident they're going to get a scholarship based on their athletics. I kind of was the artistic equivalent of that, where it was like, I don't need to focus on my academics. My art's going to get me where I need to go, which it did. Right? Maryland Institute is top three art school in the country. So it did, and it got me there on scholarship. That was all positive. But the fact of the matter was I completely neglected everything else academically until I was interested in it. And then I was diving in, you know, deep. But the problem was I had no training whatsoever. I had sort of checked out of all the sort of proper academic training. So thankfully, though, Chris Firestone, I think, is a similar sort of guy. He grew up on the south side of Chicago, and, you know, he was equally unpolished as I was. He became a math major and then sort of backed his way into philosophy out of interest in that. And so I think he recognized there was sort of a kindred spirit there in the sense of he's familiar with finding these sort of scrappy outliers who are not really your ideal academic student, and then mentoring them and things like that. So thankfully I ran into him, and there were a couple of other professors there who were also very important in my formation. And, and really what they created for me, which was what I needed, was an environment where, yeah, I kind of did what we were supposed to do in class, but that wasn't really why I was there. I was there because I was asking these questions, and people like Chris opened up the door for me to really pursue whatever path of inquiry I wanted to pursue. And we'll make it sort of work with whatever class you're in, or we'll create an independent study so you can do that. And so Chris sort of opened up the academic boundary lines where he could just sort of be a mentor and guide me through studying whatever I wanted to study, even though I wasn't a good traditional student. And it was really only later that I still neglected grades because I wasn't doing this for a career. Yeah. And that's the thing. If somebody wanted to mentor me toward getting a professorship, they would have done something different. They say, you need to buckle down. You need to get, you know, these grades. You've got to study for the GRE. Chris didn't do any of that because I think he recognized that's not who Jacobs is. So I became very unconventional in the way I did those sorts of things. And even like Chris always leaned into that. I mean, he encouraged me to submit a conference proposal, like a paper proposal for an academic conference, a professional academic conference, the American Academy of Religion. But I was an undergrad. But nonetheless, Chris said, I think you could do it. I think you could hold your own, which is now I realize is completely insane thing to say in undergrad. But Chris did, and I was naive enough to say, sure. And so I did, and I got in. And I'm there at this panel discussion, John Stackhouse. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's a Christian college. Yeah. He was my respondent to me as an undergrad. He's my respondent. I'm on this panel, this big ballroom, all these people here. And I'm thinking, like, what am I doing here? But then I, you know, sort of caught, that sort of became quintessential for the journey, is that I was like, well, I started presenting at all these different conferences. I started publishing all that sort of stuff. My book on Kant, I co-authored with Chris before I even finished my PhD. And so I have a very unconventional academic road in that way, because it was never really driven by career building. It was driven by questions. And it was done in dialogue with professors who were treating me somewhat as mentors, but more like a peer who's asking questions than they were like just an undergrad student in their class who's trying to pass the class or something like that. And I think that was very helpful and very formative. And so even when I went to TEDS, right, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and I realized I had to keep my head down a little bit given my views there, thankfully, it's still on the same campus, and I still was mentored by people like Chris and worked alongside him and others. So, and then eventually I left there to go to Calvin. And Calvin Seminary, the doctoral program there, is what I discovered was that the, you know, at the master's level where they're training pastors, it's important that we stick to like the, you know, we toe the line with our tradition. Mm-hmm. Whereas at the doctoral level, it's much more open in the sense of, you know, it's an academic program. That's what I found. So I was in there. Not everybody was Reformed by far. And everything was really sort of historical approach in the sense that, you know, the boundary lines were much looser. I mean, obviously.
That fascinates me because I remember when they were having the conversation whether or not to start a doctoral program, because in seminaries, the big thing was obviously the D-min, and Calvin Seminary goes and does a doctoral program and not a D, because D-min programs, they're the cash cow of seminaries, because all the pastors want a little bit more credibility. And so, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So that fascinates me, because that's a very, nobody has told me anything about the seminary doctoral program. It was kind of a mysterious thing happening over there. And its relationship to what you just said, just really fascinating for me, probably nobody else in who listened to me, not a lot of Christian Reformed people listen to me, but that's fascinating. So you found your time at CTS. Well, Mueller, of course, was, you know, he was brought on as a, you know, heavyweight scholar, someone who, you know, really have credentials to give that program some credibility. But you found your time there helpful.
Yeah, it was truthfully the best academic experience I had, period.
Really?
Unquestionably. So I went there largely because of the legacy of people like Plantinga and Walter Storff, right? The analytic philosophy of religion stuff that came out of Calvin is obviously renowned in the philosophical world. So I always had a high regard for Calvin. And so that was what initially caused me to look at the program. And then I met Tom McCall, who's another analytic philosopher who came out of the Calvin PhD program. And he sang its praises, you know, he was at TEDS as a professor. And so I thought, well, if he thinks that highly of it and so on. And then they gave me a very good, you know, scholarship. So, I knew that I could afford it, right? Cause it came with a full ride and a stipend. And so it was the best offer I had on the table of all the different doctoral programs I approached. So that's where I ended up going. And I found it was, what was fascinating about it and what I really liked is it was much closer to what I was hoping for when I described what is School of Athens, was because they only let in 3 to 6 people each year. And that's intentional, so that your classes are never more than, you know, around 5 people at a time. And it's because they're done in these in this way where it is very sort of free-flowing discussion. Everyone's read the content. People are arguing, discussing. And it's really training you for academic publication. So a big emphasis is on research and methodology. And because it's on a quarter system, or was, I don't know if they've changed that since, but was on a quarter system, you would end up, you know, three times a year, you were able to study only two topics at a time, which meant you could delve much deeper into this topic because it's much easier to manage only two areas of focus, right, at a time. And so that was something that was really appealing. And the end game for each class was always that you were being trained for proposing a research topic in that sort of broader field you were studying for that class and producing what's essentially a publishable essay on the back end for the class. So you're producing, you know, six publishable papers every academic year, which is pretty good output. And so anyway, I found it to be extraordinarily helpful. And Richard was great. I mean, Richard is a brilliant guy, certainly one of definitely, you know, sort of top three most brilliant scholars I've ever met. I really enjoy him. He's also he's a funny guy too. I think that was just overall was a fantastic experience, and it fit very well with my sort of independent research sort of approach. I could find the sort of topics that I wanted to research. I could delve deep into those topics. I could end up, you know, pouring all that research into writing something publishable, which is basically that's what I was already doing in my sort of pre-Calvin independent way of doing things, is everything was about doing a deep dive in an area of research until I get to a point where I feel like I've done enough research, I've come to a conclusion, I can write a publishable essay, something like that. So I thought it was fantastic, and it produces really tremendous scholars. I know it's been going through changes because Richard's now retired and things like that, and I haven't kept up too much on the state of the program at this point, but when I was there, it was top notch. I mean, it was fantastic.
Well, that's terrific to hear. I went to CTS. I was there in the 80s, the late 80s. I was going to go to Fuller, and then I had to take a fifth year at Calvin College to get on my Greek in. Mm-hmm. And that's when I met the woman who would become my wife. And I knew if I came to California that they probably couldn't maintain the relationship. So I switched to Calvin, and I actually bumped into Carl F. Henry in the dining hall one Sunday morning. I saw this old man in the dining hall all by himself. I felt bad for him. So I went and sat with him and asked him who he was. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm probably going to go to Calvin Seminary." He says, "That's a good seminary to go to because they're kind of a classic seminary." And so I, like my father and my grandfather, all went to Calvin Seminary and divs and became pastors. Now, were you married at the time that you came to Calvin? How about when did you meet your wife? How did you? You don't have to go into great detail, yeah. But
so I met my wife in college. I did do so. I'll offer briefly how I met my wife, which was I sort of picked her out of the crowd and I asked a bunch of people about her. Made a couple of failed efforts to introduce myself to her. I remember the one that was really sort of formative was when I went to a buddy of mine talking to her. He's in a conversation with her, so I'm thinking, oh, this is my chance. I go over, I start a conversation with him. He says, "Oh, hey, do you know?" And unfortunately, he didn't do that. You know, he's talking with her. I come over, "Hey, man." And he, like, does this full 180, turns his back to her, starts talking to me. And she says, "Oh, well, you know, okay." Starts talking to somebody else, leaves. And I think, what? Tell him, "What are you doing, man? I didn't come over to talk to you. I see you all the time." Anyway, I started chatting with him. And eventually he said, you know, I was like, "How do I approach this girl?" He said, "Man, why does it have to be so complicated with chicks, man?" I said, "Why can't you just draw a line in the sand and say, I like you. If you like me, then cross that line." And I said, "You know, that's a good idea. That's what I'm going to do." So I went in and got a piece of chalk. And I stopped her And I said, hey, you don't know me, I don't know you, but I've seen you around. We know some of the same people. They say you're pretty great. So I'd like to get to know you. You'd like to get to know me. And then I drew a line on the sidewalk. I said, then cross that line. And and she paused and looked around because she thought it was a joke. She's like, there's got to be somebody like laughing in the bushes. And she said, okay, sure, I'd be happy to get to know you. So she stepped across the line and I said, huh.
Wow.
I said, I didn't expect that. I haven't thought this far ahead. And so I said, well, let me think about what comes next. And, you know, and when I do, I'll find you. And I left.
No, you gotta be kidding. You set yourself up. And
and I walk. It's terrible. Anyway, if you watch the movie I did before Becoming Truly Human, Killing Poe, there's a scene in there that's based on that. So that's actually, I think that's in the trivia on IMDb about that movie. So anyway, that's the college comedy I did. Anyway, but yeah, so I met her. I ended up marrying her right out of college. And she was very much an evangelical, right? So she, and I think an evangelical who didn't really realize how far out and heretical my ideas were. And
even
most
after
people,
the chalk thing.
Even after the chalk thing, right? Like, that should have told you all you needed to know. This guy's not right in the head. And so I think she just wanted a good church where, you know, she could have community and things like that. And I typically followed along and was the sort of reluctant participant who would sit in on things and was antisocial and all that sort of stuff. And really, and oftentimes couldn't take it, right? You know, she could just tell. I'm not very good at hiding it when I'm just like completely don't want to be someplace or am off put by something. And I got us kicked out of a couple of churches because, like, there was one pastor who, you know, as I told him, you know, I argued for process philosophy and denied certain classical divine attributes. And he's like, you're a heretic.
You're an actual heretic.
You're an actual heretic. Right?
I found usually people are just indifferent, and, you know, but right. You actually believe the wrong things and you know better.
That's right. That's right. So, so I had, you know, on more than one occasion, we were basically, I crossed certain lines with, and so I, over time, realized I can't talk about certain things, but I think that was always a strain on our relationship because think she was much happier to be, you know, any number of churches would make her happy. And I just, and for me, it was always something to be tolerated and it was very difficult. So when I finally encountered Orthodox, and we had kids along the way, right? We've now got 5 kids, but when I was in doctoral program, what were we up to? We were up to 2, and then we had our 3rd while we were at Calvin. At some point in there, when I discovered Orthodoxy and had enough conversations and done enough research and said, I think I want to actually become Orthodox, I went to her and I told her, and her response was like, what's this cult you want to join? I don't know. What is this? And like really quite seriously thought like, I don't know if we need to get a divorce, right? You know, things like that. And the priest who was catechizing me, you know, I was a catechumen basically, you know, not yet received into the church, but in some sort of standing as somebody who has professed a desire to join the church. He basically said, I asked him, I was like, what do I do? Do I become Orthodox? Do I wait for my wife? What? And he told me, wait for your wife, which was the last thing. That's not what I wanted him to say, because I thought this is the first time I've wanted to go to church, like ever. So I finally find, you know, a place where somehow there's a religious practice that goes with the beliefs I've formed. And this is like coalescing into what would be a real lifestyle and things like that, where, you know, all the ideas and lifestyle and all that converge, and I want that. And instead he's telling me, like, no, wait for your wife. And I thought, oh, that's not what I want to hear. But I said, okay, you know, because he was my priest, right? So, as exercise of obedience, I said, okay, if that's what you say, Father, you know, basically in my mind, it was, if I want to be in communion with the Orthodox Church, being obedient to him is the closest thing I can, by not being Orthodox, ironically, is the closest I can get right now to being Orthodox, right? It's, I'm in proper standing with them in that sense. And so I waited and took 7 years, and those 7 years involved, it was, I mean, at first it was discussion, right? Me trying to, you know, tell my wife what I've, you know, what I've discovered, which didn't work out at all.
Really?
No, it didn't, believe it or not.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know.
Didn't she grow up evangelical? Wasn't she under the headship of her husband? Didn't
That's right. This should have been, you know, easy, no brainer. But unfortunately, she had a brain, so that was. I lamented to my priest, she doesn't want to listen to me. I don't know what to do. And he said, well, he's like, said, well, I said, I wouldn't want to debate you either. He's like, what, this poor girl, you think she wants to sit there and debate you over things that she's unequipped in? And I said, oh, okay. So anyway, so I sort of left it. I just sort of left it, you know, to God, and I'll pray. And I'll do my thing as best I can. And over time, you know, she became Orthodox, you know, in her own thinking, and oftentimes in ways that I couldn't have orchestrated or anticipated, right? I remember there was this one moment when icons are oftentimes a hang up for people who are not Orthodox and are evangelical, right? That seems like idols and idol worship and things like that. And she came to me one day and said, well, I don't want to go to the Orthodox Church with you, because I was going periodically and she would every now and then decide, okay, maybe I'll come with just to check it out. That took several years. At first she hated it and I don't want to ever set foot in an Orthodox Church. But after several years, she started saying, well, periodically, maybe I'll show up with you. And she came to me one day and said, I don't want to go to the Orthodox Church with you. And I said, okay, what's up? And she said, well, I had a dream last night, and in the dream, I feel like I came to understand why the Orthodox venerate icons. And I feel like, but I don't feel like I could personally do it. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like to not honor the icon would be to dishonor it. And so I'd rather just not put myself in that situation. Now, what she didn't realize is to not honor the icon is to dishonor it, is straight out of John of Damascus and his defense of the veneration of icons. And so those were the sorts of things where I said, okay, I'll just sort of accept that. And just things are happening. I'll just let them go on. So anyway, I mean, it took, like I said, it took 7 years for her to get to a place. And I remember the moment when I'd just taken a job at another Protestant school, because I was teaching at Protestant schools at the time, and I knew as soon as we become Orthodox, that's going to be a problem for these schools having me teach there. And so I remember I'd just taken a position in another Protestant school. I won't say which one, but she came to me after we were, we had been sitting there with couple of former student of mine who became Orthodox, his wife would also become Orthodox. They were talking to us about how they'd really like us to become Orthodox, because they'd like us to be their son's godparents. And I said, oh yeah. And Heather said, well, she said, you know, I really am kind of okay with becoming Orthodox, but you know, until Nathan finds a job that, you know, we know we can keep while he's Orthodox, like, we're not going to become Orthodox. And she said, as she said that, that sounded like, that's the worst reason I could possibly come up with to not be Orthodox, right? Like, if I really think that's where we should be, are we in some ways being disobedient to God by like not becoming Orthodox? So she comes to me and tells me that. I said, well, I wish you would have told me that before I just took this job at a Protestant school. So anyway, that was the first moment where I remember we were in this position of, you know, over the next couple of years of both being in an agreement that we should become Orthodox now, but holding off for purely practical reasons. And then our lives started to completely implode and fall apart. And I think, I don't think those two things are unrelated. But thankfully, you know, I see the hand of providence and how things have grown out of that. And that really gets to, I guess, the part where you're talking about what I'm doing right now and how the art side and the philosophy side have converged. That was when David Bradshaw, who at the time was the chair of the philosophy department at University of Kentucky, he had become aware of my work. I was aware of his work, and we had corresponded purely for academic reasons. You know, he was doing Eastern patristic metaphysics and ancient metaphysics, and I was doing the same at the time. I had transitioned off of Kant to ancient metaphysics, publishing a lot on the Eastern Fathers. And I went to him and I said, David, you know, here's what's going on. I've got to find an exit route out of the evangelical world. And just reaching out to you. And he said, oh, I had no idea you were interested in Orthodoxy. Really? Why do you, I mean, are there people who publish on the Eastern Fathers that really have no interest in Orthodoxy? Thankfully, David actually suggested, why don't you come to University of Kentucky? And I went there and I was a lecturer of philosophy there as this sort of interim stage, looking at longer term positions. And there was a couple of schools I was looking at, but what really sort of came out of nowhere was that I was approached by the Antiochian Archdiocese of the Eastern Orthodox Church. And this group, again, this interesting providential convergence where this group of people had said, well, we're going to have this meeting in Grand Rapids. And actually, you know, the folks weren't based in Grand Rapids. One was from Indiana. The other couple were from, you know, like California. But for whatever reason, they decided they could converge in Grand Rapids.
All things converge in Grand Rapids.
That's right. Yeah. Well, in January, and I had just agreed that I would teach an interim class during J-term at Calvin College. And I said, well, you'll never believe it. I'm going to be in Grand Rapids during that time in January. So anyway, so we had this meeting and they said, like, well, we want to, you know, a lot of people who become interested in Orthodoxy are disaffected, you know, Protestants or Catholics. And we're more interested in people who fit this group called the nuns, right? Not to say that, you know, we're not interested, but you know, that's where we would rather not focus there in terms of outreach, rather focus on the folks who have wandered away from religion generally. And so they made a pitch for, you know, some sort of like, could you do some videos that are like some teaching videos or something like that? And I explained why I thought that was a terrible idea. First of all, because I'm not a videographer, like I make movies, right? I have movie crews working. I don't even have my own equipment, right? Like I don't do that sort of thing. I hire a cinematographer.
You use your daughter's earbuds.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Because clearly I would have a very fancy like boom mic over my head right now if I was a videographer, which I am not. So anyway, first of all, I said, well, I'm the wrong guy to talk to if that's what you want, because that's not what I do. Second of all, just speaking as a former nun, I think I would have zero interest in what you're describing. Anyway, I mean, long story short, I pitched a film, experimental film idea, and experimental in the sense that I couldn't think of another film that does it, right? I was just like, so I don't know if this will be good or it'll be bad or it'll be indifferent, but this is what I would do. And I said, I think you need to do three things. One, you need to humanize the nuns and just spend some time listening to them and let them tell their story without any amount of judgment or response or setting them up for the, you know, apologetic, you know, uppercut or whatever, you know. You just got to let them be human beings who are on a spiritual journey with real questions and real stories. And And I said, and then the second thing you do is I think you should open up conversation and sort of prime the pump for thinking about big topics. But the fact of the matter is you put a non-religious person with a religious person, that, you know, the guard goes up. So the best way to do that is to have the unaffiliated folks talk with the unaffiliated folks, their peers, right, who they're going to find resonance with, but also dissonance, because they're not going to all agree. I said, and then if you think Orthodoxy has something to offer the nuns, which I do, and obviously in my talks I talked about ways, advantages it has in terms of mapping on top of a lot of the spiritual instincts of the nuns, I said, you're going to have to find somebody who embodies that, right? Somebody who's gone through that journey. Now, when I was pitching this, I did not know I was pitching that I would start it. But after we started going through and I pitched this thing and they approved it, and I started thinking, where on earth are we going to find this person and who would be this and so on, I eventually, with some fear and trembling, decided to say, like, okay, I'll be this person. And that was partially pragmatic also, just because it was a low budget project, right? They were not throwing gobs and gobs of cash at this. So, you know, we needed to stay in one location and I needed to know who I was working with, right? All these sorts of things. So thankfully, though, they approved it and I put my job search on hold, which was fine in my mind, because the two universities I was talking to about a position, they were actually talking about not the coming academic year, but the one after that. So I thought, that's perfect. Keep the conversation going there. Take this year off from teaching at UK and just like make the movie, right? Like, no problem. And so that's what I did. And then, much to my surprise, they said, well, we don't know how to distribute it and, you know, advertise it and things like that. So could you do that? Extend it 6 months. So they extended my contract another 6 months. And then basically somewhere in there, what happened was I sat down with the Metropolitan to show him the film after it was done. And that was terrifying because, first of all, it was the first time I'd ever met a Metropolitan. And in case people don't know, like, you have bishops over, and then you have like archbishops, and then you have Metropolitans, which are over like, you know, a country, for example. So like the Metropolitan Antiochian Metropolitan is over in North America, right? Which, not country, but you know, North America as a whole. So I think my understanding is his jurisdiction includes Canada. Anyway, so I'd never met a Metropolitan. I'd never gone to, you know, an archdiocese, like the actual building, stepped inside of one. And so here I am going to go in and say, well, Your Eminence, here's what I spent your money on. What do you think? And so that was terrifying. But thankfully, he loved it. And much to my surprise, said, I'd like to see you continue in film and not go back to teaching. And I said, well, I'll think about it, but I've got 5 kids. And so I kicked around all sorts of different ways of doing that. But, you know, the long story short was I ended up, thankfully, through some of the promotion of the film, meeting certain, let's say, mission-minded investors, right, who had a vested interest in seeing me do more film. And what I was really pitching was films that are much more viable in terms of secular wide release.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Becoming Truly Human is pretty direct in terms of, yeah, we're looking at nuns, we're talking about religion, here's, yeah, my story, I became Orthodox, right? Like, whereas I was talking about the possibilities of doing films that are not so direct as that. You know, they still reflect an Orthodox worldview underneath, but they're ultimately, you know, secular wide release movies. And, anyway, thankfully, what I found was that there were some people who were fascinated, Orthodox folks who were fascinated with that idea, who wanted to get involved from a business perspective and seeing if they could make that happen. And that's what I'm doing right now. So, and in terms of, you know, who I'm working with is not actually, it's not like I'm working with Orthodox people. Some of my investors' business side are Orthodox people. But I'm working with, you know, Mike Flaherty right now, who is the co-founder of Walden Media, Walden did the Narnia movies and Sandlot and Holes. He's not with Walden anymore. He left, I think, in 2017 to start Epiphany Story Labs. So working with Epiphany Story Labs and some other folks that we've got on the project, but folks who aren't Orthodox, but they love the projects. They like me as a director. You know, they want to work with me on these projects. So that's kind of, this is where I suppose to sort of wrap that part up is to say, some of the ways I sometimes put it is that as somebody who was trained in art and loved art, but then eventually discovered philosophy and ideas, right? Initially through crisis and then just because I love it and I think the questions matter and so on. I always found myself as somebody who felt like I had sort of two halves of myself that could never be reconciled together. You know, when I teach, I thrive, I love teaching, I love lecturing, I love publishing and writing, but then it feels like the artistic side is sort of wilting and dying on the vine. So then if I go and I draw and I paint and, you know, I do these sorts of artistic works, you know, that part will sort of thrive, but then it feels like I'm neglecting this academic side. And really only in film, and specifically doing films that are related to the world of ideas, do I begin to see these two parts of myself converge together. And that's where I think all the different components of my personality, my love for collaboration with people, I do enjoy business, art, ideas, and trying to do films that have a depth of worldview to them, but are also, you know, really works of art. That is, you know, that's the first thing that's really made sense of my journey and and that's, thank God, that's what I'm doing right now. So
are you going to continue to teach? Is that a part-time thing or are you going to do film full-time?
Well, as of right now, I'll occasionally pick up a class, you know, like I think the last one I taught was World Religions. So I'll periodically pick up a class just to stay sharp in that area.
Yeah.
But honestly, this making movies right now, what I'm doing right now is so all consuming in terms of time. I don't have time to teach. Plus my schedule becomes very, very unpredictable. You know, I suddenly need to hop on a flight and go to Boston, you know, 2 days from now. And if I were teaching, you know, I'd have to cancel my classes and you don't necessarily have that sort of flexibility as a professor. So I continue to publish and I continue to speak. Although I will say that my speaking now, even though my publishing is still, you know, referee journals and things like that, my speaking has leaned a little more public intellectual, like the stuff you saw on Inkscape, which I actually, incidentally, I enjoy. Academic talks are typically 20 minutes and they're, you know, preludes to things you're going to publish anyway, whereas public intellectual stuff like lectures on ancient faith, I actually really enjoy that and think that's a better use of sort of a speaking platform. In terms of teaching, I mean, right now, I have my affiliation as a visiting scholar of philosophy with University of Kentucky, but I have not been teaching lately because I just don't have time to do it. Obviously, if the film thing crashes and burns, I'll be looking to return to it. But my honest hope in an ideal world would be that this succeeds enough that I can just keep on doing more and more projects like this.
Yeah.
But because my business partners really value the academic side of me and what I bring to the projects in terms of worldviews and ideas and things like that. For them, it's they're interested in seeing me stay sharp in terms of, you know, being active in terms of publishing, doing podcasts like this where there's long form conversations, doing public intellectual sort of conversations like the ancient faith stuff that I did. And so because my projects are somewhat unique, just in the sense that I'm unique as a filmmaker, that means that, you know, part of the long-term vision is in some ways to keep an academic component going to it. Well, that probably won't involve a lot of teaching, you know. If it were to be there, it would have to be that there's like a university that wants to keep me affiliated because they think the affiliation is of benefit to them, and I periodically teach like 2-week modular or something like that. But I don't think this current trajectory allows for me to really be teaching full time or, you know, over the course of the semester or things like that.
Okay. Is there a film out there that people might recognize that you would say, this is the kind of thing I want to do?
Mm-hmm. It's a tough one because here's what I'd say to that. I think you have plenty of films that are, you know, thoughtful films, like let's say Tree of Life, right? Yeah. But the problem is those also are not commercially viable,
right? Because
they're think pieces that are very, you know, and even an example like Life Itself, which I know you watched, because which. Thank you for doing that. It's a great film worth watching. Even that one, it's commercially viable, but it's still in the, you know, drama category where it's going to have a much more limited audience than the truly commercially viable movies. So I would point to something like Life Itself as a good example of the type of tenor I'm trying to hit in terms of true secular wide release commercial viability. It's just a traditional movie that follows very traditional beats, but it's thoughtful and dealing in, you know, sort of multi-layered worldview issues. But the projects that I'm currently working on are meant to be much more commercially viable than a project like that. So I'm trying to utilize genres that are, you know, in my mind, oftentimes films, it's like, well, people who want to do thoughtful films either do avant-garde or they do, you know, some sort of art house film, or they do a drama if they're going for mainstream. But then you have all the sort of commercially viable stuff like comedy and horror and action and things like that. And those aren't thoughtful movies. And you sort of separate those like that. Yeah. Whereas what I'm trying to do is do movies that are trying to accomplish the sort of thing that's typically relegated to this group of, you know, art house and, you know, drama and things like that, but do them within the boundaries of the more commercially viable genres. Sure. So that's what I would say is probably a little unique to what I'm trying to accomplish.
It's a cool vision. I really want to see you succeed because I'd really love to see that.
Yeah. Well, the first project should be, if all stays on schedule, it will be done and ready for release by October 2020.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So the current project, which I can't speak to in detail, but it's in development right now, and pressing ahead with a goal to having it ready by then.
So, super. I said, you know, think about 2 hours or at about an hour and 20 now, and I do want to give you a chance to ask me anything you might want to ask, but I just finished reading Frank Schaeffer's Crazy for God.
Okay.
Have you ever read it?
I haven't. No.
You should read it.
Okay.
Definitely read it. Have you ever, you know who Phil Vischer is?
Phil Vischer, no.
Okay, you should also, Phil Vischer, he's the guy who founded VeggieTales.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And he wrote a book because he, of course, lost the intellectual property of the VeggieTales in bankruptcy court.
Because
he had never gotten good legal advice. So you should definitely read that little book. It's a terrific little book that Phil Vischer wrote, and then also Crazy for God, because part of what's interesting in your story is this, you know, so Frank Schaeffer, of course, grew up in this really unique moment of Labrie, mm-hmm. and all that was involved in there, you know, eventually became Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
By saying that I love that book, there's a number of people out there who are not going to love that I say I love that book, because there are a lot of people who are angry at Frank Schaeffer for a number of things.
And
you can criticize him for. But this, to me, it intersects in a lot of interesting ways with your story, especially in the fact of the piece of your story where you talked about how you had to go to church and you had to keep quiet because quite frankly, that breaks my heart, and it breaks my heart because I know it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're comfortably in a space now where you don't have to keep quiet because quite obviously your beliefs are in alignment with your ecclesiastical situation.
Right.
But part of what in my own crazy journey with the whole Jordan Peterson thing, I started this YouTube channel and I had people writing to me, and I am pastoring a dying, aging congregation that is in a place that the Christian Reformed Church doesn't much care about. Uh-huh. And so I had all of these people interested in talking about Jordan Peterson. And so a bunch of them who don't go to church anywhere just said, you know, well, we should do a meetup. So I just used meetup.com and said, basically, come here on Sunday or on a weekend night or weekday night, and we'll talk and we'll just have conversation. It was hard for me not to open with prayer because that's what Christian Reformed people do.
All right.
And we just have conversations. And the first time we did it, I said, well, we'll start at 7. And then about 9 o'clock, because I've run small groups as a pastor, at 9 o'clock, I'll kind of close. We'll do some housekeeping and call an end to it. But people can stay around if they want to. And it was 1:30 in the morning when the phone rang at church. And I knew exactly who was calling because it was my wife. And I knew exactly what she was going to say. It was, are you okay? What is going on? Because, you know, at that point I learned, okay, so now on I need to have my meetups and I kick them out at a certain hour. We're not an all-night bar here at the church. Uh-huh. But one of the things that I realized, and I mean that in the fuller sense of the word, was that I had always wanted the church to be a place where people could come and share what's on their heart and uh-huh. say heretical on our, and most of the people who come to my meetup don't go to church.
Right.
But I so lament the fact that the church has become, and evangelical churches of all places, because they're supposed to be the ones who don't care about the rules in order for, you know, whatever, that churches be places where people can come just to talk mm-hmm. out loud, explore ideas, work through things, find conversation partners who could be credible and helpful. And I feel so blessed by what you said about Calvin Seminary's PhD program, because for me, the church is a place for people to come and talk and be and build relationships. And so, you know, hearing your story and knowing the truth that I find it horrendous that in many churches people have to just shut up. And in your case, just had to shut up and deal with it. And then even for the sake of, you know, employment or what have you, mm-hmm. I find that to be a terribly sad thing. Mm-hmm. Because I want so much more for the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is where I would say that I see certain people like Chris Firestone, and I could name others who were influential on my journey. The fact that there was a lack of concern about whether or not my views were aligning with some sort of evangelical dogma was really important to me trusting them. And I really had no idea what Chris thought about certain things. I just knew that he was honestly engaging in the exercise of discussing questions. And that too was really pivotal to me trusting him. And I found that even in doing Becoming Truly Human, that's one of the things I found in the pre-screenings with people, is that a lot of folks had asked me after they saw the film. So, how did you meet those people? And, you know, have you continued up the relationship with them beyond that, and so on and so forth? And the answer is really no, I haven't continued the relationship with, it wasn't really... It was a relationship predicated on interviewing them for a possible appearance in a documentary. I wasn't building relationships with them, outside of that. But also one of the things that was an unexpected, you know, sort of byproduct of that was because I didn't want to taint the conversation with making them aware that I'm Orthodox, right? Well, that's what I had mentioned. As soon as the religiously unaffiliated folks are talking, know they're talking to a religiously affiliated person by default, they're just going to have a defense mechanism go up and it's going to shut the conversation down. And so whenever they would ask, well, you know, so what do you think about these things? I'd say, it doesn't really matter. We're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about you. And so all they knew was that I was the director of this film. I mean, they knew all the components. They knew that there was going to be this third story in there of this Orthodox, you know, sort of nun turned Orthodox. But they had no idea that was me. And what I was fascinated by was that the more they had a sense that I was asking these questions and really wanted to know more about them and was just, you know, sort of honestly navigating the territory of where they came from and where they're at. And I didn't have an agenda where I was looking to just sort of like, okay, now it's my opportunity and here's the opening. I can jump in now. Right. Yeah. Here's my opportunity to pounce. Right. Once they realized that that wasn't forthcoming, you know, there was this ease that set in, as well as ironically a certain amount of gratitude, which was a shock to me because I didn't see it coming, but it was the gratitude of, oh, I rarely ever get to talk to anybody about these things. And so I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to process out loud, you know, where I came from and the questions that I've had and where I'm at right now, because I don't know the last time I actually articulated any of that. And so gratitude was this odd byproduct in my mind, because all I'm doing is asking them about themselves, yeah. You know, but nonetheless, it was amazing to discover that that's so rare, to actually just ask a person about themselves and listen to them genuinely and at a level that's more than superficial, right? We're talking about much deeper things, and have no agenda forthcoming beyond just finding out about them, is so rare that it is this sort of revolutionary, you know, thing for them and their experience. I think it probably says something to how many people interact in our culture when it comes to worldview issues generally.
Well, and I think how poorly the church is doing. So one of the things that happened with my channel was I made a video with something like three things the pastor wonders about Jordan Peterson, mm-hmm. and just put that out. And then I started getting letters, and actually a friend, guy shows up in church the next Sunday with this poster and says, I've never been to church before in my life. Here I am. And it's like, okay, what have I started? Yeah. And then people start writing me emails and calling me and wanting to talk with me. And then I start having enough of these conversations that I start realizing that the conversations are repeating. So I said, well, I start asking people if I could record them, mm-hmm. and they'd say yes. And so then we record them like we're doing today. And then I'd send it back to them and say, I want you to watch this. And if you would be okay with me putting this on my channel, I want you to let me know. And they would. And this started a whole thing of just talking to people. And to me, part of it was just pastoral work, which I have always known that mm-hmm. people need listeners, but mm-hmm. part of it was, you know, then the response to this, I just had one of my friends say, you know, some of those conversations are boring. And I said, yeah, some of them are. this isn't Hollywood where we script everything and in a nice right. 2-hour package, you're going to come to a dramatic climax, so on and so uh-huh. forth. But the hunger in the world for people to just have someone listen to them. Mm-hmm. For 5 years, I had a homeless, mentally ill man who I couldn't get him to go anywhere else. He parked right against my office door. So, mm-hmm. you know, like Lazarus, I had to step over him to just come to work every day. Uh-huh. And much of our time, he would come and he'd just sit in my chair and he'd just need to talk. Uh-huh. And so then people come to me and I say, well, I can't, oh, you're my pastor. I'm not your pastor. You need to have a real pastor, which means there needs to be a real church with real people. This little video thing, this is good for some things, but this is not real life here. But the thing that breaks my heart is that so many people can't find a real pastor. And I love the part of your story where your priest told you, you know, made you wait 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't catch that from the film, but mm-hmm. that's because a lot of people are going to hear 7 years and it's like, shoot, marriages don't last 7 years. But you, and I love that because he, you know, I think he forced you, you learn to submit to the church
uh-huh.
and you learn to submit to your wife
mm-hmm.
and to her needs.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, oh, that's, you know, there's so much gospel in there. We can't mm-hmm. ignore it. So mm-hmm. I really do hope that you know, what do I want from all of this? I just watched Bishop Barron talk to Jordan Peterson or listen to that. It's out on the podcast now. And yeah. Jordan Peterson asked Bishop Barron, well, what do you want? And
uh-huh.
Bishop Barron says, I want people to know faith in Jesus Christ and be enfolded in the Roman Catholic Church, of course.
Right.
And I, you know, I really do hope that your films continue to touch people and to introduce them into hard questions. I mean, your journey is many years by the time you settled into church.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. If I calculate out, golly, I think I would say the journey started in about 1995. I mean, journey in the sense of starting to go into existential crisis. And probably I discovered Orthodoxy somewhere around, probably 2002 is when I first encountered Orthodoxy. So it's 7 years of grappling with things,
okay.
Encountering Orthodoxy, researching it probably over the next year, you know, and then, you know, and then becoming persuaded and then having to wait 7 years. So you're probably talking like 15 years of wait. And then on top of that, my wife, you know, I mentioned that we waited, right? We had this whole thing of like, well, now I just took a job. So probably 17 years. So 17 years from going into crisis mode and saying, I really have some serious questions that I think need to be answered, to actually settling someplace.
So God is a little like Laban, you know, it's like Rachel and Lee.
Well, as well as one of the things that I started to discover very clearly was that, I mean, I mentioned in the film that Orthodoxy is very much a lifestyle, right? There's a lot of, you follow a liturgical calendar and there's instructions about how you're supposed to fast and pray and to really start to embody that in some sort of way where it makes sense and it's really become part of you is its own process, right? So yeah. In many ways, I felt like just becoming Orthodox, it's not as if becoming Orthodox, like, oh, I've arrived, now I rest, right? Or something like that. Yeah. It was almost like setting your foot on a totally new journey that is still going on, you know, right now. Yeah. Because even though maybe my theological understanding of its doctrines is pretty advanced, that doesn't mean my actual ability to embody its practices are really advanced. And unfortunately, I think that's oftentimes one of the confusions that people had. It's why I emphatically said at the beginning and at the end of the film, I am not a saint. I'm not some like spiritual exemplar. Like, don't get this. Like, you want to find like, a spiritual exemplar, go to like Mount Athos in Greece and like find an elder or something like that. But like, not me. Definitely not me. And I think unfortunately there's a tendency in, you know, our Western context to conflate knowledge with maturity, you know, so that if somebody knows a lot of stuff, yeah. they're the person you want to look to.
Yeah.
And I'm good if, you know, you're looking for somebody who's, you know, an encyclopedia of information. That's so good. Like, you know, that's great. Yeah. Ask me some theological questions. I'll give you the answers, right, to those questions about Orthodoxy, if, you know, in an analytic fashion, but don't confuse actually understanding the articulation of this doctrine with actually growing spiritually. And I think that's a conflation that often happens.
Yeah. Well, I've taken plenty of your time. I don't know if you have any questions or anything you wanted to talk about before we close this up.
Well, I would be curious if we could talk again, because I really enjoyed talking with you, Paul.
I would love to talk with you again, too. And I think I will send this to you and you can look at it. And if you want to alter it or anything, you could do that, or just give me the green light and I'll post it on my channel. And you'd be just one of they call themselves randos sometimes. They send me pictures of you know, just one of the randos I talk with. So
yeah, well, sounds good. Well, I'd be happy to talk, be one of the randos you talk with. So
well, thank you so much, and I very much appreciate you taking the time to do this. And I so enjoyed your story, and I very much enjoyed your film. And I'll, you know, if we post this, I'll put links to it on there so people can find it. But yeah, deeply grateful for this.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Right. Let's talk again soon.
Okay, real good. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.